Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Guaranty Trust Bank Full Year 2020 Investors and Analyst Call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions later during the conference. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero. Please note that this call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Segun Agbaje. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. I hope everybody can help me, hear me clearly. Thank you very much. Welcome to our year-end 2020 financials call. We have circulated the presentation. I think that's been up for like 3 days, so I will take it as read and go straight into a Q&A, if that works for everybody. Thank you and good afternoon.
Thank you very much, sir. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone or on the keypad on your screen. If you decide to withdraw the question, please press star then two to remove yourself from the list. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one. The first question comes from Muyiwa Oni from SBG Securities. Please go ahead, Muyiwa.
Well, thank you. Congratulations on your results, given the difficult environment. I have a few questions. The first is an update on the holding company structure. Trying to understand where you are in terms of timelines and extra restrictions causing any delays. Would like to have a sense on what to expect with the plan for the wealth business, payments business, and also the Africa subsidiary. Suppose also having what to expect in terms of succession planning, given that the tenure as CEO and expectations from Central Bank should be up this year. I'd like to succession plan. Also think have.
Sorry, I didn't get your third question.
Muyiwa, if you don't mind just speaking up a bit, the third question.
One, you have to speak up, and I didn't get your third question as well.
The third. Okay. The third question is on the Africa franchise. I'd asked one on succession planning. Wanted to get
Yes, that's the second one.
Get a sense where things are. Yeah. Third on the
Hello?
Africa franchise.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hi, Segun. Are you able to hear Muyiwa's question?
No.
Can you hear me?
I heard the first
Can you hear me now?
Second one. I heard holdco structure, timing, and then I got succession planning, but I didn't get the third one.
Okay, Muyiwa, if you could proceed with the third question, and let's just see if Segun is able to hear you.
Okay. Wanted to get a sense of the, for the Africa franchise expected contribution. We've seen improvement in income and asset contribution, but wanted to get a sense of where things should be over the next 2-3 years. Lastly, on your view on the current interest rate environment, how to, I guess trying to understand how quickly we should expect asset yields to move or NIMs to adjust given interest rates, particularly the short end, is increasing and think.
Okay. Hello, can everybody hear me?
Also increasing as well.
Okay, let me try and take the first question. I always say I will always spend a little bit of time on each question because I suspect other people have the same questions, and then hopefully it helps. In terms of holdco structure, I think let me first say thank you to shareholders for giving us the approval at the EGM. That was an essential step to moving forward, so we have that approval. After that, what we've had to do is submit to the Central Bank. things are working a bit more slowly because of COVID, because even the regulators are not fully at work. But where we are now, we're at the final stage of approval for Holdco. So we've done physical inspection. We're just waiting for final approval and final license. So from our perspective, we're well on track. At the very worst, we will run a Holdco structure for at least half of this year. In terms of succession, just like I had always told people that we would not have a succession problem and that we would be done by the end of December 2020. Succession is completed, but you must remember, so, and we did, we were done by 2020 in terms of bank succession. However, just as we've spoken about holding companies, so it's good, it was your first question, is that apart from succession of the bank, we're also going through what you must imagine is a corporate reorganization by setting up a holding company. It therefore means that we're going to have a holding company board and we're going to have a bank board. In order to keep the operational efficiencies around the organization, both from a cost basis and efficiency perspective, we're going to have a 7-person board at Holdco level, and we're going to have an 8-person board at the bank level. That way, you will see that the two numbers will not be very far from what we have as a bank today. We have decided that it is appropriate, based upon what I've just said, that we announce the holding company board and the bank board on the same day, which will be after we get final approval for the Holdco. So where we are is internally at a board level, succession as far as Guaranty Trust Bank is done, Holdco board has been formed, bank reorganized board has been formed, and we will announce this, and we think the appropriate thing is to reveal both on the same day after final approval so that investors and shareholders have a complete picture. In terms of the African franchise, as you rightly pointed out, African franchises today are 15% of the loan book, 20% of the deposit base, and 15% of profit. However, one thing we had promised over the last couple of years, if you've been following our calls, was that we wanted the African subsidiaries by the end of 2021 to contribute $100 million. And we're well on track. They did $85 million last year. So we're pretty confident that we will meet the $100 million target. Obviously, in the perfect world, we would like to diversify our earnings base. Part of what is taking us into the holding company structure is diversification of earnings. Earnings outside of Nigeria also constitute diversification. So I would hope that over the next 3 years, you will see us pushing to 25 to 30% in terms of contribution from outside Nigeria to the whole without Nigeria slowing down. Now, you talked about the interest rate environment. I think that we're going to have a year of two halves, and you started to see that. In terms of open market OMO bills, we're at 10%, which is about 11% yield, so we've moved from about 1% at the beginning of the year. In terms of NTBs, we're at about 7%, so we started to move. What has not yet moved are loans, or what I would call asset pricing. And my belief is that that will start to move by the second half of the year. There is some resistance now on the loan side, but I think it will happen. So my expectations of interest rates have started to play out, and they started to go up. And I think you will find that they will go up even more in the second half of the year. So I hope I've answered all your four questions.
Yes, you have. Yes,
thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Adesoji Solanke from Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead, Adesoji.
Yeah, hi, Shagun. Good afternoon. Adesoji from Renaissance Capital. Hi, yeah, I have a couple of questions. So, first of all, just three questions on relating to cash reserve and special bills. So, the first one is, I presume you received the CBN special bills in December. I may be wrong, maybe it was January. So I'm trying to understand why we haven't seen a reduction in your restricted balances vis-a-vis the special bills you received. And, I mean, these special bills, when do they mature, and what do you think happens to them at maturity? And the third related question is, what are your thoughts on the likelihood of having your cash reserve invested in FGM bonds as the CBN securitizes its ways and means loans with the federal government? And what sort of pricing do you expect on these securities? My next two questions are just, considering the significance of FX revaluation gains in your 2020 earnings, firstly, where do you see the FX rate setting this year? And secondly, can you run us through how you anticipate making up for those gains if they do not repeat this year, as you've guided for a $5 billion increase in your profit before tax in 2021? Then finally, the provisions you made in Q4 on your Stage 2 loans, what did this relate to? In your slides, you
I kind of lost you. After FX rates and revaluation, you asked, I missed you after that. You kind of cut off after that.
No worries. I'll just repeat my questions. So the first one was around, considering the significance of FX revaluation gains in your 2020 earnings, firstly, what do you see the FX rate setting this year? And secondly, can you run us through how you anticipate making up for those gains if they do not repeat this year? As in your guidance, you expect a $5 billion increase in profit before tax. Is the provisions you made in Q4 on Stage 2, what did this relate to? Because in your slides, I believe you mentioned this was related to one specific client. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Roger. Let me start with CRR. I believe that we took $411 billion in special bills. So that is already in the figure you see. So when you look at, if you look at it, our investment securities went up by 27%. The reason that increase is so high is because of the special bills. In actuality, we only had bills of about $336 billion. So the special bills are in the figure you see at year end. In terms of what I see, as far as I know, these things are going to be rolled over. They're being rolled over every 90 days. So I expect that we're in about a 3 to 4 year program and that they'd be rolled over every 90 days. Now they're being priced about 0.5. So I think we should look at the special bills like a rolling program, like you would have a bond program. If we're going CRR into bonds, of course, it would depend on the tenor of the bonds that will determine what type of yields I would like to see. Considering we're at about 1 year, at about 10 today, I would hope that it would be probably north of that. Can you still hear me? Because sometimes I'm on this webinar and I'm hoping that I'm not losing people.
We can still hear you, sir.
Okay, fantastic. Now, the second question. When I look at the results, Soji, revaluation gains are $37 billion. But for me, that is really not, and I will still address your question in terms of FX rate. I'm not so sure that's what we did very well in the finances of 2020. I think what we did well in the financials of 2020 was the structure of the balance sheet. And that the fact that in a period where yields were dropping, the asset yield only went from 11.9 to 11. We were able to bring down cost of funds from about 2.3 to 1.1, so we had NIMs of 9.2 on a balance sheet that grew, even if you put in CRR. And that was the beauty of that result, that in an environment where everything was coming down, we kept the NIM and we still kept interest income. And so the balance sheet contributed a significant part of the profit. And that the revaluation gain of $37 billion, I think we'll be able to replicate it. Because even if you look at exchange rates, we converted at 410. We might go for 20, 430, so that will make up some of it. When we took our revaluation gains as well, if you notice, we didn't take any revaluation gain on our swaps. So out of our long position of $1.7 billion, we only took revaluation gains on $1.1. It therefore means that if those swaps, as those swaps unwind, we're going to take almost like a 46 to 50 naira revaluation gain on $613 million, even if the rate doesn't move from where it is. So I think we will be able to make up whatever we made in revaluation gains from the two things I've said. You might have a slight depreciation, which will give us something on the 1.1. And as the swaps unwind, we'll take the revaluation gains from the last time they were revalued, which was done at 364. Then stage two loans. We looked at the environment coming out of COVID. We looked at our loan book. And we decided that we have a restructured loan on our books, which is WEMCO. It's a large manufacturing company. They have a lot of assets. But, you know, it's not necessarily assets that pay back loans. It is really cash flow. And so we've taken the prudent position to start to put some money away towards that. So we put away about 9 to 12 billion for WEMCO. And we're basically saying that if anything happens and we ever have to take a haircut on that credit, we've looked at the assets. We don't believe the haircuts will be more than that. And so we'll be fine. We won't have any haircuts in the future. It also gave us the chance to look at the ECL model and look at kind of build COVID into it a bit. And so we took our loan impairments up from 4 billion to 19 billion. I hope I've answered the question.
Yes, just two quick clarifications. So the first one is around, can I hear me?
Hello, Shugin, are you able to hear Adesoji?
No, I don't know if he heard me completely there.
Yes,
I did.
So
I just had two clarifications. The first one is on WEMCO. So for the WEMCO exposure, just remind us, what's the size and what's the percentage provisioning overall you've taken on WEMCO? And the second question is, on your numbers, for the $613 million, so let's assume in 2021 you decide to, let's say those swaps mature and you decide to take on the gains. What is the value of those gains? Is it simply 46 by 613? Is that the right way to calculate this gain?
Yeah. So it will be about 28 billion.
Okay.
So that more than compensates for the 37 billion growth we had. On WEMCO, it's about a 60 billion exposure, so we provided about 20%. We've given ourselves a buffer of 20% on WEMCO, which is why we've kept about 12 billion. And the 613, if you just take the revaluation from 364, will give us about another 28 billion.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rudy.
Thank you. The next question comes from Ronak Gardia from EFG Hermes. Please go ahead, Ronak.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Shagun, and thanks for taking the time
today.
My first question is on, again, NPL's restructured loans. Could you just remind us what proportion of your loans have been restructured and what kind of performance are you seeing on these loans? My second question is maybe if you could just spend a bit more time in terms of what GTB could look like post the whole co structure. I know, you know, you've spoken quite a bit about investing in your payments business, maybe acquiring a PFA business. So if you could just talk about, you know, what the structure of the business would look like post the holdco. And specifically within that, yeah, just a bit more time on the payment side of things. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think restructured, we're about 17%. And a large part of that is really the state governments, which we had to give a moratorium of 1 year. We haven't had any real explosions as a result of restructured loans. The one we feel a little bit nervous about, which is WEMCO, we've taken a provision on it. So I think in terms of restructured loans, the number 17% is really because of the state government loans, and we're pretty comfortable. Post-Holdco, obviously we have the banking business. The banking business will be Nigeria, as I've always said. It'll be West Africa, it'll be East Africa. Then we'll have the payments business, and then I'll come back and talk a bit more about it. And at this point, we're probably 60-70% confident that we will have an asset management business and a PFA business. obviously for, I have a non-disclosure on, we will make an acquisition. We're pretty far gone in terms of negotiations and agreements. Deals can always fall through, but I'll say we're about 60 to 70% at least on this deal. And we've agreed all commercials and everything. So it's pretty clear that that's kind of what we'll look like, and then there'll be the UK. In terms of the payment business, we're still very excited about the payment business. We like the valuations. We think it'll be a valuation kicker for the group. What we are obviously going to try to do is leverage a lot of the business. Most people today, everywhere, if you look at Googleplex, if you look at Citi, if you look at Goldman, everybody's partnering with a fintech. The beauty about our situation is that we will be partnering with our fintech. So we think that you'll see a lot of synergies. It will probably allow our fintech to reach break even and get to scale quicker than most people's because you have a strong bank behind it. The one thing we will not do, and I must emphasize this, is we will not do transfer pricing. Any business that fintech does will be addition to what the bank would have done. And so we're going to be very careful about that. We're not going to create a situation where we're just moving money around. So, but we're very comfortable. We're very far gone. We have basically finished the strategic plan of the payment company. We have the approval in principle. We're waiting for the final license, which we think will come out at about the same time as the HoldCo license. So that's kind of it around our, you know, we will leverage the bank. We'll have a merchant acquiring side. We will work with the bank on a mobile wallet strategy, and we will probably take this strategy to at least three countries. We'll take it to Ghana, probably Cote d'Ivoire and Kenya, so that we can build up scale very quickly. So when you say what will GT Bank look like post HoldCo, we'll have GT Bank Nigeria, we'll have GT Bank outside of Nigeria, which contributes 15% today, which we will try to push to 25%. We will then have the new businesses, which we don't believe will really contribute materially in 2021, but we're hoping that at least they'll take no money away from group, and that by 2022 they'll start to pay their own way and add to group figures.
Yeah. Okay, just on that, just maybe spending a bit more time on your payments. If I look at the USSD volumes, it's been growing quite sharply the last 3-4 years. What's the industry comparable? Sorry for maybe if I'm sounding a bit naive here, but what's the industry comparable here? Am I looking at industry NIP volumes? And if that is the case, when I compare your USSD volumes to NIP volumes, it seems you have a roughly 2.5% market share, which seems quite small. So maybe you could just talk a bit more on that.
Well, first of all, you shouldn't look at that. I think, well, first, when you look at NIP volumes, you should always look at transaction count, because that's where you make money off. You really don't make money off if you're doing large transactions. You make money off the count. And depending on what week you look at, we're easily on the outflow about 18% of NIP volumes, and on the inflow we're about 15-16%. So we have a very, very, very high number. And if you look, like I said, if you look at NIP volumes, value doesn't tell you much because you make money off transaction count. If you look at our USSD is growing about 37%. I will reserve my own comments about USSD anyway, because I think ultimately we're going to go with end user billing. You're going to see more of a migration from USSD to mobile banking, because USSD will become an expensive channel for users. But no, absolutely not. We're very strong in terms of our USSD volumes. I believe we're probably no further than number two, actually. And that's why on the outflow we're about 18%, and on the inflow we're about 16-17%. And what really counts is, what really matters is count, not value, because you don't make money off value, you make it off count.
Okay, understood. And just one final one on this. When you look at the total value within the system, which segment is dominating the value in that value creation within that segment? Is it the banks? You know, it seems like you have a significant market share. or are the fintechs quite a big part of that equation? You know, we've seen the likes of Flutterware and et cetera raising quite a bit of money. So where does the value lie right now?
Okay, if you look at, and since you know the NIP volumes, if you look at that, you will find out that the total combination of all the fintechs and all the MMOs is probably on the, I think it's all either on the inflow or outflow side, but forgive me if I'm wrong, there's one part they're not even playing in. But I think on the inflow side, they're about 18%. So all of them put together about 18% of NIP. So if you take it from that perspective, it's still bank dominated. If you have the number one bank at about 18-19% and number three at about 16-17%, and then the number four is very close, probably like 15-16%. So you're still talking pretty much bank dominated because the fintech's only 18% of NIP.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. The next question comes from Timothy Wumble from APSA. Please go ahead, Timothy.
Thank you. Thank you, Shagun, for the call and for taking our questions. Just a couple of questions that I want you to answer.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to, so can you speak up a bit? It's very low, and I want to hear your question properly. Sorry.
All right, yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
Fantastic. Great. So the first question I have is on what is keeping asset quality in Nigeria so pristine? I want to get your sense on that. I mean, we've seen what I'll call a Tory idea with the GDP contracting. What is keeping asset quality so pristine? And I don't know, in the same conversation, what impact are the intervention funds having from the CBN? I think they injected about, I believe, trillions of naira. Is that having, I don't know, is it possible that one can use those funds to refinance on their existing obligation? Just want you to maybe answer, maybe that is contributing to the good asset quality. The second question, and maybe forgive my ignorance, is on the decline in your credit-related income, credit-related fees. I can see in the presentation you write capped credit-related fees. I'm not familiar with what exactly that means, so maybe just explain why we saw that decline, despite some growth in your loan book. On USSD, I think you've partly mentioned it right now. So what sort of impacts would you see? I don't know, maybe suppose we're going to quantify it right now, but clearly there will be an impact from the fact that the fees will be passed on to the consumer. What sort of impact might you foresee in 2021? And then just lastly, on fintech, what will the fintech arm do that bank currently isn't doing? I mean, you do a lot on your banking platform, yeah, on your app. What will a fintech do outside of that? Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, I'm just scribbling very quickly here. Fintech new biz. Okay. The first question on asset quality. I think that if you look at it, if loans are going to go bad, especially where you've been granted concessions by the central bank right now. You've been given moratoriums on a lot of things. And so maybe it's early days. So let's see what happens in 2022 when a lot of those like concessions are taken away by the regulator, what will happen to it. But for right now, like you said, they seem to be holding up quite well. You have been given more lenient restructuring terms. People have been given moratoriums. So let's wait and see when those go away. The one thing I can tell you about intervention funds is you cannot use them to refinance. In fact, they're not allowed to be used for refinancing. So that would have little or nothing to do with the asset quality. Intervention funds have probably worked, and that's probably why Nigeria got out of recession so quickly. I think most people didn't think we'd be out relative recession as quickly as we did, but with the amount of money pumped in, which you can refer to as a stimulus that went directly to businesses, I think it helped us get out of recession. In terms of what I mean by credit fees, under the old banker's tariff, you used to be able to charge management fees at renewals of facilities. Now you cannot do that anymore. So, for example, if you had a five-year facility and you took a credit fee in year one, under the old banker's tariff, in year two, you would have been able to take a management fee on outstanding balance, which I'm sure you're very familiar with because that's a lot of how the multilaterals give loans. But under this, it means that you can only take a credit charge or a management charge on a loan once in the lifetime, irrespective of how long the tenor is. So, of course, that affected our fees a lot, because in the past, we would have taken that loan book and essentially charged a management fee on all the outstanding loans, but we couldn't do that anymore with the new banker's tariff. And that's what you see as the drop in fees, or what we explain as the drop in credit fees. Look, for USSD, like I said, USSD grew 37% last year, whereas mobile banking grew 48%. I think that mobile banking is a quicker, simpler, and has become a cheaper option when you start doing end-user billing for the users of it. I also believe that, as you've seen in India, it wasn't very successful. And that as it becomes a more expensive channel, the cost of data is really what is prohibitive now in Nigeria. I mean, I don't have the exact figures, but I think data in Nigeria that is about $1.27 is about 3 cents in India. And that at 6 naira 98 kobo for USSD, people will move to mobile banking. I don't think as banks we're going to lose a lot of money, because we weren't charging for USSD streaming. What we were charging for are things like NIP, which are regular banking services, bill payments, statements, our regular banking services that we would charge for when you came off any other channel. What I expect you'll see is a shifting from USSD to mobile banking. So I don't expect you'll really see any material impact in 2022 financials. If you looked at our, 2021 financials, if you look at 2020, that hit already came. Our NIP charges went down by 3.9 billion because a new tiered charge was introduced. What are we going to do differently? I think we're going to have as a fintech company, first, we don't have a strong merchant acquiring business as a bank. I think you'll see that the fintech company will have a very strong merchant acquiring business. I think the other thing you will see is that the bank, as well as the fintech company, will have a very robust mobile wallet strategy, which the bank doesn't have today. But on the back of the fintech technology and platform, we will have an aggressive mobile wallet. And that's what I mean. That's the collaboration we're going to see between the fintech and the bank, where today the bank is not building a mobile wallet strategy. We will, going forward, on the platform of the fintech. The other thing we're going to do is, please don't look at our fintech as only just there to serve the bank. I think you will find that our strategy around our asset management company, as well as our PFA, is going to revolve around the technology platform that fintech builds as well. So we're bringing more than just banking solutions when we're talking about the fintech we're creating. I don't know if I've answered your questions.
Yes, you have, Segun. Perhaps just lastly, I think last year, half your call, you did state that you don't revalue your bond portfolio, your fixed income portfolio, but under other operating income, there's a massive increase in your MTM. I think you indicate MTM on your fixed income portfolio. Just clarify on that. Thank you.
Okay, I'll pass that to Banju, but as far as I know, I think I know what it relates to, but let him give you the technical answer. Hello, Banji, are you there? I think he's trying to get in. Hello?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could please remain online while we try and establish a connection with his line. If you could please remain online. Thank you.
Okay.
Right, perhaps as we wait for you, maybe I could just add. So on the fintech, you know, just want to also get a sense of, is he back on the line? Sorry, if he is.
Hello, this is the operator. Can you hear me?
Okay, like I was saying, we do evaluate the portfolio, but depends on the profiling and the point of origination. So what we did was, most of our deals were fair value through other comprehensive income, because at the beginning of those bills, we actually profile them as bills that will be fair value through OCI. For the ones which is like 90 billion, which you are fair value through P&L, you see when you look at note 15 under other income, we actually recognize 4.5 billion. Because when you look at the yields within the portfolio, it's far better than the yield offered by market. So when you convert that to pricing, you see that resulted in 4.5 billion at bank level. And also 4.5 billion at group level. So why the other one? Because as all those OCI cycle out, have reduction, and you see that in other comprehensive income with the second layer income statement. And what you find on that when you look at OCI, you have 2.3 billion coming through this year compared with 4.2 of last year. So, on aggregate terms, what we favor through P&L 4.3 and through OCI 2.3 billion. So, they are actually disclosed in the financial statement. Note 15, other income, and under the other comprehensive income, you see the 2.3 billion. That is not favor through P&L, so you don't see that in income statement. But rather, you see it on the second level income statement, which you call consolidated OCI, other comprehensive income. So that's the way we have treated it in GT Bank.
Okay, thank you, Banji. Thank you very much.
Right, just to clarify, okay. So are you saying the reversion is on the T-bill book only and not on the bond book? Is that what you're saying?
Sorry?
Yes. Can you repeat the question, please? Can't hear you.
Sorry, apologies for that. Let me ask again. I'm asking, so are you saying that the revaluation is only on the T-bill book and not on the bond portfolio?
No, we do not have a large portfolio of bonds, which is why when you look at our fixed income portfolio, it's 99% treasury bills. So what we've done is to look at how do we profile. Like I've explained, either we fair value through P&L at origination, or you profile through either amortized cost or fair value through OCI. So you will not see any significant value coming at the back of bonds because it's less than 1% of the portfolio.
Right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, you had one final question on the fintechs, I think, before Badji came up.
Oh yeah, just to wonder whether, you know, are P2Ps possibly one of the best opportunities, perhaps, you know, just trying to find out, and does fintech compete with mobile money? No, sorry if I sound very clueless, but maybe just give me an answer on that, then thank you very much.
We're not going to start that way. I think, like I said, in terms of what would resemble mobile money, we will work with the bank using their mobile wallets. However, as a holding company, if we think there's an opportunity there, the holding company will be allowed to apply for a PSB license. So if we think there will be opportunity in that space, it might be something we will do.
Thank you very much. The next question comes from Gloria Fadipe from CSL Stockbrokers. Please go ahead, Gloria.
Yeah, good afternoon. Please can you hear me?
You'll have to speak up a bit, please.
Oh, okay. So, I just want a bit of clarification on the whole culture. So, I'm a bit curious about the PFA. I understand that valuations for PFA businesses are a bit quite steep at the moment, and I'm wondering what you intend to do to get the kind of scale that will justify the kind of valuations, buying valuations you will be probably getting. And then just to get a sense, from all of what you said, looks like the payment business holds the best prospect for you amongst these big businesses you're going to be taking on. Would that be correct? And finally, on your loan growth for last year, please can you just tell us which was real loan growth and which were, what percentage of that was as a result of the evaluation. Thank you.
Okay, let me do the easy question first. We had 10.8 as group. We had about 8.9 as bank. About 7% of that was down to revaluations. So you're probably looking at about 3.8% real growth after you take out devaluation. In terms of PFA, well, I guess you'll have to tell us if the valuations were rich when we announced to you how much we paid for it. I'm not so sure that is as rich as, I'm not so sure we overpaid. Also now anyway, you can move your RSA, so that creates an opportunity for a good PFA. Guaranteed Trust Bank has a very, very hopefully strong retail base, has a good brand that we can leverage. When I look at the PFA space, I think most people are still playing very wholesale, and that we have an opportunity to create a retail PFA business. I also think we have the opportunity to do the same. So yes, you might think I'm really excited about the payment business, but that's because that's what I've had a lot of time to x-ray. I'm just as excited about the asset management business and the PFA business, because what you look at is what we're creating here is a financial services company that once you do business with us, we'll meet all your needs. So we'll meet your retirement needs. If you look at the business model of Guarantee Trust, it's a low-cost operator. It has a cost of funds of 1.1%. That's deliberate. It has a mix of 89-21. That's deliberate, which means that we lose some money to people who are looking for high yield. We will lose that money to ourselves in the asset management company. So we're excited about everything because everything's a synergy, and what we're doing is creating an ecosystem with Holdco. So we are very excited. The Payco will do merchant acquiring, give us a technology platform that is quicker, easier, cheaper. Asset management will allow us to play with customers who want more yield, and PFA will allow us to deal with your retirement. So we're as excited about every business we're going into. It's very deliberate.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Lanri Buloro from CHD. Please go ahead, Lanri.
Hi, Shago. It's Lanri from Chapel
Hill. Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Just timelines. I know you talked about, you know, approvals and everything, but can you guide us on when you think the whole co will be unveiled, fully approved? And similarly, just, you know, in line with that too, is the MD and the, I guess the MD at the Holdco, which would be yourself, also, is there CBN approvals for that? Then you talked about your PFA. Maybe you can guide us around what the size you think, you know, AUM type, I mean, the targets that you're looking at. I mean, can you give us a ballpark? Let's give specifics.
Okay, well, in terms of timelines, honestly, like I said, every time I hear this, maybe because we've been at this for about 18 months, we realize how much work has gone into putting together Holdco. So the one thing I can assure you is that we will run for a Holdco for at least 6 months of this year. That's the worst case you will see. So by the second half of the year, we will run as a whole group. If we're able to do better than that, we will. Everything, just like I said, in as far as the holding company, in final approval of the holding company, all the appointments and the board of holding company, which includes myself, will be done. We will go for the approval of the managing director of the bank after the announcement. We've looked at the criteria and we've looked at the eligibility. The person is obviously an executive director today, so we don't think we'll have any problems with that as well. PFA, we're not going just
the way the, I think it was Glory who called from CSL had said, the valuations are really bad, so we bought a fairly small one. And the reason we've also done that is because we're not intending to do a wholesale strategy in terms of our PFA. We're going to do a retail strategy. So I think the less legacies we have in what we buy, the easier it will be for it to implement our own strategy.
Okay, great. And just to understand, you know, where the question is coming from is, it's while the macros and the market is quite volatile, you know, we've seen the share price, you know, somewhat come down, and you know, it was stagnant for a while. And we're trying to realize, or trying to see if it's related to the uncertainty around OLCO, around new management. You know, I mean, do you have any view on why your share price has been turbulent?
No, we like our share price. Actually, gave you a dividend yield of about 9%. Sure. I don't think I always tell people, I really don't worry about the share price. I worry about the fundamentals of the business. So if you were smart enough to buy it when it was coming down, then you got a dividend yield of 10%. I don't think our share price has done any worse than anybody else's. I think after we announced our results, we went up at about 6-point-something%. So I actually think the market's given us value for the fact that we're transiting. The other thing which I'm thanking shareholders for is that when we went to the EGM, we got overwhelming approval for the holdco structure, which tells me that our shareholders are behind us.
Okay, great. Thanks. I guess one more thing is just on the FX. I didn't get your answer earlier around your views and where you think it should. What should be the naira dollar, you know, exchange rate, like ideal?
Well, you know, ideal is always the relative word. It depends on so many things. If we were having this conversation when oil was 28, I might give you a different answer. Now we're having it around 64. Well, we're coming from about 70. So I always say, look, on the worst day, even if you take somewhere between 420 and 430, I think we're fine at the kind of oil price we have at 420. 430. And if you do that and you take the yield, so if you take the yield on the 1 year, even if you did a 420, 430, it means you'll get a real return of about 6-7%, which is probably better than a lot of African countries today. So pretty comfortable at about that level.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. The next question comes from Abbas Musa from Meristem Securities Limited. Please go ahead, Abbas.
Hello, good day, everyone. So I want to congratulate you on a wonderful financials at the end of the year. So quickly, given that you intend to grow non-interest income by diversifying earnings based on the holdco structure, I would like to know what measures the Guarantee is taking to drive interest income, seeing how muted it is at about 1.15% growth. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, you know, the 1.5%, in my opinion, considering what the operating environment has been like, is actually very good. If you look at those financials, we actually grew deposits 38%. We grew the loan book. But as you can imagine, a lot of your growth goes into CRR, which was earning zero for most of the year. And then even when you got bills, it's 0.5, which is what special bills are. But what we will continue to do is just continue to grow the volume and continue to scale up. We're not going to cry about CRR or cry about all those things. That's the environment we're in. What we're looking to do is we will do a lot more aggressive customer acquisition. We will grow our deposit base. So we've shown you that we intend to grow the deposit base by about 25% in our guidance. We will go into loans, look for about 10% growth. And so rather than focus on just our interest income growth, I think if we can focus on the growth of the balance sheet and we can focus on preserving the NIM at the 8% we've guided, then we'll be fine. The key is less the interest income growth, more the growth of the balance sheet, which on the deposit side and the loan side, and the fact that we can keep our NIM at about 8. I think if we do that, the balance sheet will give us the type of money we need.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Wale Okonmeboye from Sigma Pensions. Please go ahead, Wale.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for your presentation. I just have two questions. One is on your staff headcount. I noticed the number is down. I think this is probably the first time in a while. What's going on there? And then secondly, can you talk through the losses in UK and the Tanzanian subsidiary? What's driving that? And then if you could provide some color again on what you described about the board changes at the bank and the holdco level. I didn't really get that when you said it earlier. That would be all from me.
Okay. Let me start. You know, if staff is going down and you're still, I think we're getting more efficient anyway, and that the business is going away from a lot of bodies and you're using a bit more technology. So I think we're fine from that perspective. Our staff attrition was 7% for 2021. So, sorry, for 2020, which is the lowest. Sorry, I'm in 2021. For 2020, so at a staff attrition of 7%, we're not very worried about absolute headcounts. The attrition for the two previous years was actually worse than that. Losses in Tanzania. Tanzania, what we've been there 2-3 years is greenfield. It bothers us too. We haven't achieved enough scale. I think once we finish achieving the right amount of scale, we'll be fine. So just like we used to tell people about Cote d'Ivoire to please bear with us and give us a bit of time, we think this will be the last year of losses in Tanzania. In the UK, we're very careful. We don't export risk into the UK, and we don't import risk from the UK. And as you can imagine, a lot of what we're doing in UK is really mortgages and placements, and there's really been no yield whatsoever in placements of surplus funds, so that affected us a lot. They've been paid out in mortgages. Because of COVID, there was not a lot of traveling and a lot of booking of mortgages. Basically, where we make our money from in the UK is our highest earning assets and our mortgages, which we didn't book a lot because people were not traveling. Placements, we really couldn't place. Yield was very low. LC business, fund transfer, it was generally a low year. We try to keep a low-risk model in the UK. We're hoping that things have picked up this year, as things pick up this year, will be a little better. What I said about the Holdco board and the bank board is that Holdco board will consist of 7 people, bank board will consist of 8 people. It means that when you take the size of both boards together, we won't be very far from what the bank board used to be. That way, we're not just piling costs onto the Holdco. We're not just bringing things onto the Holdco that will take money away. And that as an institution, we've always been known for our cost containment and our efficiency, and that this sort of structure will ensure that we continue to preserve that.
Well,
I don't know if
I've got
a question. Yes, that'll be all from me. Yeah, thank you. That's fine.
Thank you very much. The next question comes from Tim Chang Guatao from Meristem Securities. Please go ahead.
Okay, hi, Shagun. Good afternoon. So, as a follow-up to the question, if you could...
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, now I can.
So, a follow-up to the question on your standard business, if you could comment on...
you're breaking completely. Can you get something that's stable? Because you keep breaking.
Is it fine now?
Yes, it is now. Thank you.
Okay. So, I was going to ask that you comment on your African business in general, how you're thinking about it in view of the Continental Free Trade Agreement what you have to rise from there and your whole school structure. So, how are you thinking about your African business design Secondly, I'm going to get your comments on why you haven't seen the decline in tax.
Sorry. I got African expansion. Now, yes. The new one starting, I haven't heard because, sorry, like I said, your connection's breaking. Yeah.
Apologies for that. Is it better now?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm really asking about your taxes. So, at the beginning of 2020, when the Finance Act came on board, the expectation was that we should see a significant decline in taxes paid by banks. That was the expectation at the time. I've seen that play out in a number of your in the books of a number of your peers, and I'm wondering why it hasn't played out for Guarantee. Any comments on that? So,
okay, good things. I'm not an accountant, but before I bring accountants in, I will tell you about layman's understanding. The Act helps you if your income, a lot of your income, is what they call non-cash flow income, which I'm not necessarily sure is good for your quality of earnings. But if a lot of your income is cash flow income, which means it derives from your balance sheet, then you will not see as much tax saving. And that's the very simplistic answer. But I'm sure a tax person can do better, but I don't want to complicate it. But that's really what it is. If a lot of your income is cash flow based, comes off your balance sheet, you won't see huge tax saving. If a lot of your income is non-cash flow basis, then you will see that advantage. Now, let me try, and if I don't, please forgive me and ask me again because the line was breaking. In terms of African expansion, I think what you were talking about, I said earlier on that African expansion, when you look at the slide, you'll see that those African subsidiaries today are 15% of loans, 20% of deposits, 15% of profit. But that's really not what excites us here. What excites us here was that we had said to ourselves that by the end of 2021, we wanted the subsidiaries to contribute $100 million. They did $85 million in 2020. So we're pretty comfortable we're going to hit that target. We think our African subsidiaries will become more and more relevant. We're going to pay more attention to them, and we're going to drive the subsidiaries a bit. It's easier to drive from the base where the subsidiaries are than it is to drive from the base where the bank in Nigeria is. So African subsidiaries will become, I think, more important going forward in terms of contribution to group.
Thank you. That will be all for me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. The next question is a follow-up question from Ronak Gardia from EFG Hermes. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I've got three follow-up questions. Firstly, on your deposit growth, I see on your presentation you're targeting deposit growth of 25%. Could you just break that down in terms of what your expectations are for industry-wide deposit growth and market share gains? And also, how achievable is that deposit growth target? Because I would imagine a big chunk of the deposits that you gathered last year could potentially leave the system as depositors find alternative asset classes or, you know, find asset classes with higher yields. So could you just talk a bit more about the deposit growth? The second question is on staff costs. Maybe this is just a follow-up question from what Wale was asking. So if I look at your average staff cost, it's roughly about 40 to 50% lower than what your peers are paying within the Tier 1 space. So could you just talk about how that is possible and how sustainable that is? And the final question is on your payments. So if I've heard everything you said today, it seems like you're in the process of setting up sort of a financial supermarket kind of model. What's the addressable market for that type of model? You know, we know Nigeria has 200 million people, but the per capita GDP is low. It's been declining, given the low nominal GDP, depreciation, etc. So what's your addressable market for that kind of business model? Thank you.
Okay, let me start from the bottom. I'll start from payments, which comes... It's a bigger question you've asked me. Nigeria has 200 million people. But every time people give me these stats about GDP, I always laugh. If you look at Guaranty Trust, 52.5% of our deposit base comes out of retail. Over 50% of that comes from what you would call poor people. So I guess what I would say to you is that, you know, five thousands, ten thousands add up to a lot of money. So when we look at even the payments business or the asset management business or the PFA business, we're ready to go down market. 5 years ago, we said we were going to 25 million customers. We're at about 23, 24. And that is the strength you see coming through of the retail base. And just like I said, please, that retail base is not all high-end, because over half of that deposit base is what you would call mass retail, which is little bits of money that come up to a lot. That's why we have about 21 million savings accounts. So I think in terms of what you can do with payments, depending on which product you're selling, if it's your mobile wallet product, you will see that you can probably get to, I mean, when you look at the telco numbers, how many people have mobile phones? That is your potential market for people who will have wallets. And so if there's a bank, you have a wallet strategy, and you have a payment engine to drive it, your payments business will grow. Same with the merchant acquiring side. Even if we, every other person in Nigeria is an SME. So the market size for merchant acquiring, depending on how you position it, is large. So I really think these are businesses that can scale up across board. And I think we've proven that with the bank, and the bank has shown us that. In terms of staff cost, it depends. You know, it's not really the numbers. It depends what type of staff you're carrying. Because probably if an assistant general manager to managing director, you might find that that is 40 to 50% of your payroll. So if your staff composition is more of a triangle with a wide base, then even with a larger number, you might have a smaller payroll because you're running the bank with more junior staff. And you might have organizations that are running the bank at very and much senior levels where the staff are a bit more expensive. So staff costs and numbers will not necessarily give you the answer. You have to look at the composition and the levels. You're right, deposit growth is going to be challenging, but we have one advantage that we think we can still play. When we finished 2020, our mix was 89% low cost, 11% time deposits. We think we can still, we can tweak with that mix without damaging our NIM. So part of our growth can come from the fact that we're willing to pay a little more, alter our mix a bit, and that will give us some growth, even amongst people who are looking for yield. I don't know if I've answered your three questions.
No, you have. Just a final one on payments. Is there any specific companies globally that you've seen that you'd like to model GTB to become?
Yeah, I think more Alipay.
Okay. Fingers crossed and good luck.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ronak. The next question comes from Abdul Bello from WSTC Financial Services. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon, Shekou. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
So, I have a couple of questions. So, my first question is that earlier during the presentation, you mentioned that the bank did impressively well with the slight reduction in asset yield from 11.9% to 11%. So I want to ask how you were able to achieve that environment. And my second question is that I saw a marked loan growth in the agricultural sector in the composition of your loan book, about 49% thereabout. And so I just want to ask what the driver of that was. Okay, and so I also saw that the oil and gas sector account for about 39% of the group's loan book. And I understand that the bank sort of has some hedging policy in that regard, but I'd just like you to tell us things that are in place, you know, to manage the potential risks that could come with, you know, such a significant exposure. And on page 42 of your financial statement, there were lesser customer complaints in 2020 in terms of number, about 35% reduction. But in terms of amount involved, 100 million thereabouts. So I'd just like to ask what the bank is doing to improve customers' experience in terms of frequent downtime, your online banking platforms, error messages on website, and, you know, other issues. Thank you.
Okay, let me start from the bottom up. It's just always easier. In terms of customer complaints, let me first start by apologizing to anybody who's a customer who's experienced some of it. I think we've been stable. What we found is that first we had to go in and look at everything we've built. As you become a larger organization and you go more technology, you find that your architecture gets a bit more complicated because you're adding on a lot of services. So we've gone in, we've looked again at our IT architecture, we've hired top firms who are now going to help us support it, and we've kind of redesigned the architecture. We think we're kind of out of the woods, we apologize. There will always be complaints. We will always have the channels, but the idea is to make sure that we are proactive in making sure those things don't happen. So I apologize. It was our IT architecture that got a bit too complicated and too complex in design. In terms of oil and gas risk, we look at oil and gas risk very differently from the way you have. In terms of the risk of the upstream, it's very different from the risk of the midstream or the risk of the downstream. In terms of upstream risk, that's where we do a lot of hedges, because truthfully, you know, it's not bad risk. As long as you keep producing and you've hedged it, you'll pay your way out, even in downturn. And if the price even goes beyond your hedge, you can always elongate. And we've always told people that, which is why you see that the losses in our upstream book are next to nothing. Even when we went through the whole Forcados shutdown, people eventually paid. When we look at midstream, we try to be a bit more careful because that's where you have people who do pipelines. We don't do a lot of vessels, by the way. So when you look at our midstream, it's not really vessels. There's a lot of like pipelines and infrastructure. And that's tied to a lot of IOCs or marginal field operators. And so for as long as they're doing well, the midstream is doing well. So we're pretty comfortable with our oil and gas risk. And as you can see, knock on wood, we really haven't lost money there. The place we think is a bit riskier is downstream. And so we're very careful. And you can see that's only 1% of our loan book. So we dimension the risk in oil and gas very differently. We don't look at it the way you looked at it we don't look at it as 39%. We take the risk of upstream, we dimension it. We take the risk of midstream, we dimension it. And we look at it as three sectors with different vagaries of risk. At Greek growth, I think we did a couple of interventions. So even though the percentage is high, the absolute amount is not high if you look at it, because these are intervention loans and we started from a very low base. How are we able to maintain our yield? Very simple. It's like two or three things. The first thing is that in 2019 we went long on our bills. So for most of a large part of 2020 we had our yielding bills. Also, the other thing too you must remember is that if you look at the composition of our loan book, it's 25% local, 55% foreign. On 55% foreign side, there wasn't really any repricing. So when you take the loan book portion that is in FX, and you take the fact that we went long on our bills, that's the explanation why we didn't have a yield crash on the asset side. I hope I've answered your question, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, just one final reminder. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. The next question is a follow-up question from Adesoji Solanke from Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead, Adesoji.
Yeah, hi, Segun. I just have a few more questions. The first one is, on the cash reserve, I'm just trying to understand, are these securitization conversations happening with the central bank? And do you have any possible timelines on when CBN potentially allows this conversion from cash reserve to bonds to happen? That was the first question. The second thing is, I noticed you didn't publish digital revenues in the slides this year. Can you give any guidance in terms of what you anticipate fintech revenues look like on an annualized basis in year one or year two? And what sort of EBITDA margins do you think fintech unit has? And two more questions on fintech. In terms of the core tech spend to build out fintech, what sort of nominal annual spend do you anticipate these units would have? And in terms of the fintech carve-out itself, just understand your personal distinction. What are you actually separating from the bank, right? And the question is on M&A. For your banking businesses in West and East Africa, you've previously spoken about M&A in some of these countries. Where is your thinking at today, whether it's in Kenya, Cote d'Ivoire, or any other country, or even Ghana, for example? Thank you.
Okay. There's been no discussion, at least that I'm aware of, on conversion of CRR to bonds. So I'm unable to shed any light on that. I apologize that we didn't give you digital revenues. We dropped from about 13 billion to 9 point something. So we lost about 4 billion. Let me explain what that loss is, really. That loss came from NIP. If you remember, before January, we used to charge 50 naira for every NIP transaction. That then became like layered, where if you did transactions under 5,000 naira, you paid 10 naira. If you did transactions of between 5,000 and 50,000, you paid 25 naira. And if you did any transaction over 50,000, you paid 50 naira. So even though we grew the volumes, we actually dropped in that the average charge went from 50 naira to 18 naira. So we went from about 13 to 9 point something. So I apologize that we didn't disclose it. In terms of what I think we're going to do in fintech, I've already started to explain some of it. I think that, like I said to you, you're going to see us do a lot of mobile small payments. You're going to see us do a lot of merchant acquisition business. There are services today which third parties give us, which we're going to take away because our fintech can do it. And that's why I said it's not transfer pricing. If you're giving us the service that we can build and we can give ourselves, then we're not going to pay someone else. So we have some of those. So, I mean, what I think the operational cost that we think, including a huge part of the cost, is the cloud cost. Because if you're going to have technology that works flawlessly, you're going to host a lot of it on the cloud, which a lot of banks are not comfortable doing, but as a fintech, you can. So we think our operating expense, of which a large part is cloud cost, will be about 1 billion naira a year. So when we joke amongst ourselves, we always say before the payment PayCo pays itself any money, has to make 1 billion naira. That's kind of what we set ourselves. That once we cover 1 billion naira, we're paying our bills, and then we're just growing. In terms of the subsidiaries, I think the place we'd still like to do business, do an acquisition, is Kenya. I think Ghana's doing well enough. If we change one or two things in Ghana, we can grow ourselves. We're like number 6 or number 7 now. There will be some decisions that we'll make that will allow us to grow more internally. So if we're thinking of any sort of acquisition, it'd still be Kenya.
So just to understand, just to clarify, on the fintech side, so my understanding previously was that there's certain payment franchises that are currently within the banking entity, which would now be listed under the payment unit. But we've also mentioned that there's certain expenses which currently go to third parties, which are now bring in-house. Is that pretty much what this fintech entity is, whilst adding on to my additional products like wallets?
Of course.
Online acquiring, offline acquiring.
I'm not going to sit here and tell you my PayCo strategy, it's taken me 3 months. This is a public call. I'll tell you what I think is important. If what we wanted to do was just an add-on, then we wouldn't have separated it. The whole idea is for this company to stand on its own and make its own money without the bank. And that's why I told you that the merchant acquiring business is very important. In fact, the people who are running this fintech are very, it's very important to them that they have their own identity and they have their own business model. That's the best way I'll put it.
Okay, super. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, just one final call. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. We will pause to see if there are any further questions. Mr. Agbaje, we have no further questions in the queue.
Thank you.
I hand it back to you for closing comments.
Well, thank you very much, everybody who has listened in. And, you know, I hope at least we've given you some comfort and we've answered your questions to some level of satisfaction. We'll never be perfect, but thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.